falling into place. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Wednesday edition of American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM. 5 o'clock, we're here every Friday.
We're here Wednesday
Wednesdays and Friday.
Too.
From 5 o'clock. Boy, it's tongue twister.
Yeah.
Let me try that without gum.
Muy complicado.
Much better. You shouldn't chew gum on the radio.
I'm told. You shouldn't chew gum and talk at the same time.
So there. Less the gum. Start again. 5 o'clock. Welcome to American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM.
It's like Groundhog's Day.
I'm your host, Tom Ryan. With me, my lovely host, co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan.
You'll get it right one of these days.
You know what I'm gonna get into this right away before I'm just gonna get in trouble if I keep trying to.
Yeah, don't
do the intro. Apparently, I'm still too distracted. We started a series on Wednesdays, a few months back, which we were calling the Alternative Top 40, where I'm trying to pick 500 albums from 1964 until the present. Yeah, 500. I know it's crazy.
Yow.
And I'm trying to arrange them all in chronological order. I'm picking albums that never made the top 40, the Billboard top 40 list of albums, which means if it already is popular, well, then it's not really alternative.
Right.
This kind of started with an argument that I had at one point in time, thinking
discussion.
That it was kind of funny. Yeah, discussion. A lively conversation.
There you go.
Regarding the group Nirvana, which everybody was referring to as an alternative group. And I'm like, they have a number one song. They have a number one album. If you're number one in the country, why are you alternative?
Right. How does that make you alternative?
By definition, you are no longer that. I mean, does alternative mean a style?
Right.
Or does it mean what the word means?
That's what it started to, they tried to do in commercial radio when they were going to start playing it.
And I love Nirvana. I think they're a great band. It's just that when these categories begin to become contradictory in nature to what they actually represent, they begin to bother me. And I'm never really big on categories anyway. So by looking at albums that never made the top 40, it gives me the chance to look at every genre, regardless of what it's called.
Yeah.
Finding stuff that maybe flew a little bit under the radar and give us a chance to talk about one album per show and see where we're at. We're about to start our 10th show in that series. To recap, the 9 that we've already done, if you're interested, number 1 was the album Folk Singer by Muddy Waters. The second album we did was Jerry Lee Lewis, Live at the Star Club. The third album, believe it or not, was a Bob Dylan album. Bob Dylan's fourth album, Another Side of Bob Dylan, did not make the top 40. And we
it happens.
Had some interesting discussions about why that might have happened during that show. Played that album. The fourth album we covered was by Solomon Burke. His great album called Rock and Soul. The fifth album was Presenting the Fabulous Ronettes. And our sixth album was A Love Supreme by John Coltrane.
Some of those are really just mind-boggling that they weren't more popular.
I know. I mean, I definitely thought that with the Ronettes. I mean, okay,
it
had 5 top 10
it's
hits
like
on the album,
almost.
You know, and yet the album barely cracked the top 100. I think it stopped at number 96, if I recall. B.B. King, Live at the Regal, was the 7th album that we covered in this series. The 8th album was a British band. We covered Them, the first British artist, I believe, on our list for the alternative top 40.
Mm-hmm.
They were at number 9. And the 10th artist was Otis Redding's Otis Blue. Now, the reason there weren't very many British artists that are on this list is because if we started in 1964, that was the year that the British invasion was going full bore. So most of the British acts that were around were making the top 40.
Uh-huh.
So they qualify already.
Right.
Top 40, they're top 40 artists. What ended up happening, rather ironically, is that it was the American artists that weren't hitting the charts.
They were getting short shrift.
And that's exactly the case with today's entry, which is a blues band from America, Chicago, the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. Here we are in America buying every single blues-based album that's coming out of England. We're buying the Yards. We're buying the Animals. We're buying the Rolling Stones. And we're buying them in huge numbers. We're putting both these artists into the top 10. And here we have a homegrown act, the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, coming out of Chicago. And their album stalls at number 123. It's doubly weird if you think, if you check into it and you realize that not only did they have, you know, Paul Butterfield as the singer and the harmonica player of the band, but he was able to hijack, if you will, the rhythm section from Howlin' Wolf's band.
Oh my goodness.
So he's got the hottest blues players.
Yeah, realer than that.
Right. So, you know, it makes you wonder, what do you think? And then, of course, then you put on guitar, one of the most hot guitar players that ever came out of the blues, Mike Bloomfield. And you put them all into the same band, and you've got something which makes the Yardbirds look almost like also-rans.
Yeah.
You know, and yet America just got it weird. We got it wrong. You know, we weren't looking in our own backyard in 1964 or 1965. Now, this album was a 1965 record when it came out. And as I said, it's simply called the Paul Butterfield's Blues Band. We're going to try to play the whole album. So let's just get right into the first track to give you a taste of what was happening. Basically, think about the British invasion happening and all these other bands playing their big beat versions of what is American blues. And here is this suddenly coming out of Chicago, the real thing. Paul Butterfield Blues Band with Got My Mojo Working. Great blues from the
Man,
Paul Butterfield
incredible stuff.
Blues Band. And you know what? You know, we were talking about this during the break, Heidi and I, and it really needs to be said, although it could make us uncomfortable. I mean, it's 50 years on, but with all this talk about what's happening in society these days with, you know, black culture, white culture, and the way that society is still having difficulties as far as, you know, resolving issues. If you really face it, back in 1964, the reason why we were able to listen to blues so easily from Great Britain is because they were white artists. We were hearing white versions of the blues, and it was a lot easier to, I guess, to absorb that. You didn't have to worry about, you know, what your family would say if you were suddenly, which is really a horrible thing to say, but I mean, this is...
It's cultural barriers.
It was cultural barriers that were being set up, so it was easier to hear the blues as being performed by, you know, British teenagers.
Eric Clapton.
Yeah, than it would be to hear real blues played by, you know, by the black American artists. Now, in this instance, though, the band was, I'd say three-fifths white. It was a band that was more or less split down the middle.
Band.
It was an integrated band. But the singer and the lead guitar player were white. But there's that issue in 1964, 65, where that could have been perceived as a problem. And it's such a drag because it must have held them back just for societal reasons. And it's exactly kind of really what the blues were about at their essence.
It's incredible.
You know, not just the way
that it's
being... Yeah, right, the irony. Because it's not just the way that it's being played. It's the meaning of what is being put into it. And these Chicago guys, they know what this is about. I mean, you can understand, Paul Butterfield's going through some really serious, you know, business. Coming off as a serious blues man in Chicago.
Right.
And, you know, having how many black players do you think were going to be giving him a hard time for trying to usurp their style?
Mm-hmm.
And he gets accepted for being the real thing. And the British players didn't go through any of that. There was nothing even remotely like that.
Trial by fire.
They just got the records, played, you know, imitated the records, and ended up getting hits.
Right.
It was kind of wacky. But it only went to number 123 here in America, but posthumously, it got ranked number 476 on Rolling Stone's list of the 500 greatest albums of all time.
Unbelievable.
So there's a good second for you.
Yeah, well, second wind, huh?
Right. Downbeat Magazine ranked this album at number 11 on the top 50s blues albums of all time. So how about that? Here's another reason why. Here's track two from the album. This is Born in Chicago.
My father told me, son, you had better get a gun. Well, my first friend went down when I was 17 years old. Well, my first friend went down when I was 17 years old. Well, there's one thing I can say about that boy. if there's someone left to play the game. Well, now rules are all right if there's someone left to play the game. All my friends are going fever and things just don't seem the same. Nothing's just don't seem the same,
true master of the Southside Chicago blues sound, Paul
yeah.
Butterfield, with what is certainly one of the better blues bands to be coming out of the Chicago in the 60s. Probably really the best, because at this point in time, the blues were obviously going through a change.
Right.
You can see this is exactly where, in a lot of ways, you could say this album is the album that causes the turnover in what happens. This is really where black culture starts to walk away from the blues, because I'm sure you can only imagine if you heard your favorite type of music being played by people that you were listening to for your whole life, and then all of a sudden you hear the exact same songs coming at you being played by 17 and 8-year-old British boys. You're going to be thinking, like, they just robbed my culture. It would have been weird. So there's like, has happened so often throughout history, the black audience that existed for this type of music moved on to something else. R&B was beginning to come up. That lasted until that became usurped and abandoned, and this went on and on with everything. Soul music, same sort of thing. It's pretty much the history of black culture. It's almost a shame that black culture has to keep moving from what it invents and creates, because it's such a beautiful thing, and it works, and it's great when it's shared, as you can hear by the Paul Butterfield Blues Band and their approach of it. I mean, Paul Butterfield got so much, you know, from his talent, from watching people like Sonny Boy Williamson and Junior Wells. These are like,
yeah,
you know,
a lot of richness there.
It's major influences. That track that we just heard was written by Nick Gravanitis, however you say his name. He was another Chicago guy, a friend of theirs, who had written that song with a real deep feeling for what was happening at that young of an age, living on the Chicago South Side. In an integrated area where everybody's immersed in the blues. This is a traditional song, I suppose, that is credited to Butterfield for his adaptation. I just think this is so hot. Listen to Mike Bloomfield's guitar on this song. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a masterwork by Mike Bloomfield. This is Shake Your Moneymaker.
Sometimes the things you will, you got to shake your money maker.
talk about playing with authority and getting right
he
to the
owns
point.
It.
Under 2.5 minutes, and it's just this incredibly hot slide blues guitar on that track, and just a great, great performance all around by the
down
band.
Down to business.
Totally definitive. We're playing the Paul Butterfield Blues Band first album in its entirety. It's part of our home music. I'm sorry. Well, part of our alternative top 40 series. We're going to try to pick 500 albums that flew under the radar to a large extent. This album qualifies as it did not make the top 40. It only reached number 123, in fact, and has now been met with a tremendous amount of accolades and praise, deservedly so. You might notice, if you think about the time when this was released, now this is 1965, recorded probably over the summer, released in the fall of 1965. What was happening around this point in time? This is very close to around the time when Bob Dylan was considering going electric and was paying attention to what was happening in the Paul Butterfield Blues Band.
Oh, yeah, he was. He was taking notes.
He sure was. Guess who he used for his guitar player? He lifted him right out of this band. That's Paul Butterfield that went electric with Bob Dylan.
Really?
It was
wow.
Paul. It was Mike Bloomfield who played, you know, when they got booed at the folk festivals. It was all Mike Bloomfield. This was all happening at around the exact same time.
Wow.
You know, Mike Bloomfield's holding down his role here as pretty much the guitar rock, well, blues rock god in the Paul Butterfield Blues Band. But he's making history by playing on Bob Dylan sessions and getting lots of love and hatred for it all at the same time. Let's continue taking a look at the album. Let's play two in a row here. Let's hear Blues with a Feeling and Thank You, Mr. Poobah.
What a lonesome feeling when you're by yourself. Yes, someone that you love has gone off with someone else.
That's hot.
Phenomenally ad-libbing their way, really, through a jam on a Toll Bar Blues there, a swing blues that is just incredible.
Yeah, that was great.
Thank you, Mr. Poobah. Before that was Blues with a Feeling. Did I neglect to mention the organ player's name, Mark Naftalin?
I think you did.
Obviously quite a talent. And even more so, it's even crazier, did I neglect to mention that the second guitar player is none other than Elvin Bishop.
Oh, wow. No wonder it's... Yeah, that's an all-star crew right there.
In this band from the beginning. I mean, you're talking this. It's hard to, you know, it's really hard to get much better than this when you're talking about mid-60s blues records.
Man.
Let's play one more track. We'll finish side one, and then I'll read a couple of the couple paragraphs from the liner notes of the back of the album that I think are pretty, you know, definitely worth sharing with the audience. Here's a Paul Butterfield Blues Band doing their version of a Willie Dixon song, Mellow Down Easy.
Jump, jump here, jump, jump there, jump, jump, baby, everywhere. Gotta mellow down easy, baby. Gotta mellow down easy, baby.
So go to read these liner notes. You got to keep something in mind. It's hard to imagine this now, but in 1965, blues music is a relatively new idiom to the mainstream white audience, any white audience.
Yeah.
Even the blues collectors that were becoming obsessive about blues, folk blues, early folk blues and stuff like that, were just beginning their journey around this point in time in 1965. They were just discovering it.
That's it.
The Bach audience had known it for decades, but it really never crossed boundaries.
Right.
It was here when it happened, and it's bands like the Paul Butterfield Blues Band playing obviously contemporary blues, electric blues, not worried about the past, doing something with what they are trying to do with this as being something which is truly a contemporary thing. By not worrying about tying it to the past, it was a good thing for Paul Butterfield because he's not going to come off like a sharecropper. It just doesn't make any sense. So, you know, the fact that he's able to play electric blues in Chicago and do it in his own style was obviously a good thing. But I only say this because you have to understand the time and what people were beginning to come to terms with. I mean, the blues was a relatively new phenomenon in 65 for the white audience. So I'm reading this from the liner's notes. part and parcel of the rising tide of interest in the Negro blues that has been swelling over the last decade has been the evolution of a number, as yet very small, of talented young white blues performers. For the most part, these young city-bred performers have tended to concentrate their energies on the older country blues approaches, the very styles, in fact, that most tenaciously resist the kind of surface interpretation the white blues men are able to give them. It is these songs, inextricably bound up in the social and emotional fabric of the culture they so faithfully mirror, that cry out for a kind of performance beyond the mere duplication of stylistic surface. The accomplishments of the ones who do it successfully have been doubly impressive by virtue of their having been produced in the face of the formidable, one is tempted to say insurmountable, obstacles that stand between the white singer and the blues.
Wow.
There is one white blues man, however, for whom these obstacles do not exist. Paul Butterfield, an intense, wryly humorous 23-year-old Chicagoan, is by all odds the most consistently stimulating, unaffected, committed, and thoroughly satisfying of all young blues men on the current scene. A consummate, powerful singer who phrases with ease and natural swing, wholly without artifice or the hip posturing of his contemporaries, and a nonpareil blues harmonica player. This stunning album, Butterfield's debut recording, is impressive on all counts. His singing is relaxed, insinuating, and vigorous. His harmonica work throughout is rhythmically incisive, charged with deep feeling, and reveals an uncanny, virtuosic mastery of every aspect of the instrument. And the playing of the band, notably lead guitarist Mike Bloomfield, is admirable, strong, direct, and churningly powerful. More than just being idiomatically correct, it swings like mad, and it never lets up.
Very cool.
Well said. That was written by Pete Welding, the man who wrote the liner notes on the back of the album. Here's the first track on side two called Screamin'. It's a Mike Bloomfield original.
Thank you.
Back-to-back traditional style blues that were written by the band members. The first track, Screamin', was a Mike Bloomfield original. That last track was titled Our Love is Drifting, which was written by Elvin Bishop and Paul Butterfield together.
It was a good traditional love, lost love song.
Or see you later, baby song.
Something like that.
I tend to write essays for most of these, for each of these albums. So I'm going, this is as good a place as any to read what I've got for this one regarding the Paul Butterfield Blues Band album. If you're going to steal the blues, you may as well steal from the best. Paul Butterfield already had guitarist Elvin Bishop, and somehow they managed to pull Howlin' Wolf's rhythm section away from him.
Wow.
Adding drummer Sam Lay and bassist Jerome Arnold into the mix. That made the Paul Butterfield Blues Band one of the first truly integrated units in rock and roll, but that barely tells half of the story. Mike Bloomfield was already legendary around Chicago as one of the most singularly talented blues guitarists to come from the Windy City, or anywhere else for that matter. As the story goes, Paul Rothchild of Elektra Records was in Chicago to see the band on a friend's recommendation. After the show, he went around the corner and saw Mike Bloomfield playing with another group. He suggested that if Butterfield would hire Bloomfield, a record deal would ensue. The rest, as they say, is history.
Wow.
The band would release only two albums with Butterfield, but whoa, what albums they were. Both this record and its follow-up, East West, which featured the 13-minute title track, redefined the blues here in America. This is the exact point where American blues history shake hands with the new generation. The virtuosity of Howlin' Wolf's rhythm section, teamed up with two of the country's hottest guitar slingers, made some of the English blues bands look feeble in comparison.
Oh, totally.
Bloomfield tried to balance his band obligations with outside session work, most notably as a guitarist who helped Dylan go electric on Highway 61 Revisited, and most notoriously at the Newport Folk Festival. Still, this debut record by the Butterfield Blues Band features some of Bloomfield's most exciting playing and a strong, sympathetic band, rendering the British competition negligible in comparison. Here's a couple of tracks that I think you will know, classics of the genre. First, we'll start with Mystery Train, and we'll run that into a Walter Jacobs tune called Last Night.
Thank you.
Killed the hour with just enough time to play the last song. But before I play it, I just wanted to mention the second album, which it did not make my list, but it came so close. I sometimes it's one of those that you think about, maybe I could go back and add it. You know, and the reason is this. The reason I didn't add it is because side one has got blues songs similar to this album, but they're not quite as definitive. Mm-hmm. And side two is one long song. It's a 13-minute song, but it's an amazing 13-minute song. It's called East West, and it's essentially Mike Bloomfield playing in a raga style, where he's breaking down his runs so that he's not using like the regular Western notation for his leads.
Oh, he's a total hippie.
Right.
That's awesome, though.
So it was like this sort of like this blues hippie thing happening, and he was able to stretch it out into this
really interesting
fusion that was happening for a 13-minute track. The name of that album is East West. And it might not be as definitively easy to enjoy as this album is, but it's absolutely worth, you know, checking out if you're into. If you like this, you ought to check that out, too. All right, then we got one song left. So here's how the album wraps up. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. And we hope you can join us again on Friday, speaking of the blues, as we continue our How Music Changed series on Mr. Eric Clapton. See you then. Meanwhile, here's the Paul Butterfield Blues Band with Look Over Yonder's Wall. I'm